travel. Let's take a trip. This is just a map of the old Silk Road. I'm not sure, I didn't have time to look up and see how far back that goes, but I'm sure it goes back quite a long ways. It is amazing the vastness of our globe, and
really we live in a unique segment of time in terms of all of history. We have about 10,000 years of history, and it's not until the 1800s we get electricity. 1800s we get the ability to navigate the seas, not just by the stars north and south, but then being able to figure the longitude and the latitude, and now with satellites, and I mean the technology that has taken off in the last 200 years has so changed life that it's a little bit difficult for us to imagine what it's like, you know, before that. We are so accustomed to jumping in our vehicles and running to town that's 17, 20 miles away, or going to the city 60 miles and back in the same day, and we don't even think anything of it. We blast down the interstate at 70, 75 miles an hour and think that, you know, we get upset when we get slowed down behind a truck or something. We're just so accustomed to speed. The world has really shrunk in this last 200 years. We have flight, where we can now get to just about anywhere in the world within 24 hours. And that was not the case in the time the Bible was written. And so, shall we take a trip? Well, back then, you probably wouldn't. At least not a very long one. Travel was so unpleasant that you would never want to do it casually or for recreation. It was something that was done by businessmen, by those that were making trade caravans, bringing their goods from afar and selling them. It was business, and it was government. And it was military. Those were the key individuals that were traveling down through the ages until you get to the Roman Empire. Things improved a little bit because of their road system. But even then, to really take advantage of the Roman road system was for the elite. It was for government officials and very wealthy individuals. The Bible Manners and Customs put it this way: when a traveler sets out on his journey, he must pay all debts, provide for dependents, give parting gifts, return all articles under trust, take money and good temper for the journey, and then bid farewell to all and be merciful to the animal he rides on. When's the last time you filled out your will before you hopped in the car? We don't even think that way. But if they were taking a journey of any length, it was a major undertaking. And they wanted to make sure everything was in order because they might not come back. Something could happen along the way. So it was mainly done for necessity and not for casual visits. And so, you know, it kind of helps us understand a little bit about why, like John the Baptist, didn't recognize Jesus. Though they were relatives, they may not have spent much time together. Mary went down once to visit before Jesus was born. That may not have even happened again, because travel was just not a pleasant thing. Even the wealthy would hire others to do their traveling for them. And a businessman, you would think if you're going to invest a lot of money in the purchase of a load of grain or other goods, that you would want to watch over that, but they wouldn't. They would hire somebody else because if you went down with the ship, you're not making any more transactions. And so, you know, the ship can go hire somebody, some lackey that can take care of it, and if it goes down, you can continue in business and buy another load of grain. Let's look at Ecclesiastes 11, 1 and 2. Okay, as he's writing there, he's talking about the uncertainty of life, and especially here in trade. And you don't put all your eggs in one basket. You divide it up. And so you were careful in doing business because of the uncertainty of life. 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 26. So here Paul is recognizing he's been on many journeys, but then you see the list of what comes after it, one danger after another that they had encountered. And so, you know, it's better to stay at home if you don't have to travel. Of course, ships were one way of making travel a little bit easier. Some of the early ships in would go back to like river travel. Egypt would have very light boats that they would run up and down the Nile River. They allowed the current to take them one way, and then they'd put up a sail and allow the prevailing winds from the north to push them back upriver. And so that was a convenient way, but their boats were very light and would not really be able to sustain the storms that were out on sea. Early ships were light, even up through the Roman times. At that time, the cargo ships were heavier duty, but the warrior ships were made so light that they would have a hard time sustaining a storm at sea. Israel had very few suitable places for a harbor, and so they never really developed a maritime industry. We think of that even today in the news the last year, trying to get aid into the Gaza Strip. Biden had a pier built, and it wasn't going very well, and the first storm that came up destroyed it, and I think it was done. You know, we spent millions and millions of dollars trying to build that thing, and it just wouldn't work because of the position and the way that the storm currents and things went, and not easy to offload things there. Solomon did make a fleet of ships, but to build a ship was really something that only a very wealthy person or a government would do. 1 Kings 9, 26 through 28. Okay, so he was a very industrious person. He was one that was willing to take a risk. He builds the ships, but he doesn't have anybody to sail them, and so he gets help from the Phoenicians. The Phoenician people were a sea-going people, and so he brings them in to run his ships and to train his people how to run the ships. And they had some success, but did you see how long their journeys were? I think it was 3 years. So they talk about casting your bread upon the waters. They send the ship out 3 years before it comes back. And so I don't know exactly where they were going, but the things that they were bringing back were exotic and So they had gone quite a distance. 1 Kings 22 and verse 48. Okay. God was not pleased with that plan, and those ships were destroyed. So later in the Roman times, passengers were an extra to the cargo. The cargo is the main moneymaker. In fact, you can see that even back before the Roman times. We have a certain book of the Bible about a man that was trying to get away from God. Any of you kids remember that story? He got swallowed by a whale. Jonah, right? He's heading to Tarshish. He gets on a boat and he's leaving. When you realize the danger that these men experienced and the fear that people had of setting out to sea, he was really desperate to do that. Travel on land was hard enough, but to travel at sea, you were, the main purpose was the cargo. You as a passenger, you didn't have a nice fancy cabin to take shelter in. You didn't have a nice bunk. You didn't have meals prepared. Oftentimes you had to bring your own food. There was no chef on board ship to provide you your meals. It was not a comfortable way to travel. He was that desperate to get away from God that he was willing to do that. Many of the boats were coasting craft. We kind of saw that in our study in Acts, how Paul was going from town to town and down along the coast. The passengers had to find their own shelter at each stop, and they had to provide their own food. If they wanted food on the ship, they'd have to bring it with them. Weather conditions were so dangerous at certain times of the year that Rome actually outlawed travel between November 10th and March 10th. Let's look at Psalm 107, verses 23 through 31. We have such large ships today that some of the milder storms at sea, you wouldn't hardly even notice. They ride over multiple waves at a time. But a smaller ship, they would go up with the wave, and then they went down with the wave. And it just felt like they were mounting up to the highest height and then being plunged right down into hell. It was going straight, and there was no bottom to this thing. And so it was a terrifying experience in those smaller crafts. And he says this was, they had personal experience with the mighty works of God. And I think about that when you go camping in a tent. A storm comes up. In the house, you don't notice it so much. You hear some rumbling of thunder. Sometimes you see a flash of lightning. But when you're in a tent, you experience every moment of that thunderstorm. The lightning just seems like it is coming right down your tent pole. And that's kind of the idea there, that they were that close to God's creation and the mighty works, the storm that God would bring onto that sea. They experienced every minute of it. And it was terrifying. It brings them to their wits' end. And what happened for those that were on Jonah's ship? Did they think that they were going to make it? They feared for their life. And it was evident that they feared for their life because they did something. What did they do? They threw all of their cargo over. That was all of their profits. And then some. I mean, that was, they threw that cargo over. They were desperate. And then what they do? They threw Jonah over. I mean, they were just so completely desperate at the hands of that storm that they were willing to take a man and chuck him overboard. What a tremendous, fearful experience being at sea would be in a small boat like that. So in emergency conditions, the cargo was thrown overboard. Sometimes cables were run under the ship to try to hold it together. And they did this in both directions, that you take those cables and I suppose you droop them over the nose or of the ship and work them back. I don't think they would be diving under the ship under those kind of conditions. And then cinching them up over the ship to try to pull that ship together. So what's the problem at this point? Your ship is trying to come apart underneath of you. And the one of the things they're trying to keep from happening is that kind of the backbone of the ship, that beam that runs across the bottom of the ship, if it would get pounded too hard, it would break and the whole ship would be lost. And so they would run cables in both directions to try to suck that ship together. Acts 27 and verse 17. Okay, this was a common practice even up through like the British Empire. They had a different term for it, but it was something that you did at sea in wooden vessels under extreme. There are two major descriptions of ancient sea travel given in scriptures. Of course, we've talked about Jonah, but Acts chapters 27 and 28, we won't read them because we've already kind of going to come across that in our study in the book of Acts. It's considered to be one of the most accurate account of a sea voyage that we have in ancient literature. We have a few other things that I think of, like Homer writes about sea travel somewhat, but this was a very practical description of what it was like to be on a boat. The ships had two rudders, one on both sides at the rear of the boat, and there's been some change in boat design. Their boats were at a peak at the front as well as at the back, and so you got this V-shaped back of your boat, and you had a rudder on both sides, but you only could run that rudder a certain amount of angle. So if you wanted to turn, you turned on using one rudder on one side. You wanted to turn back the other way, you had to use the rudder on the other side, rather than putting a rudder at the back of the boat that could go both ways. So it was a little bit different in steering. And so only one is mentioned in James when we read that this morning about the tongue and the ship being guided by a rudder. Well, that's because they only would use one to guide the ship at any one time. Romans often painted eyes on the side of their boat, and so here we have a Roman boat. Not all of the Roman boats had oars. A lot of their military boats did, but I think the description of Paul's travels, he's describing a boat that was only driven by sail. But you see the eyeball drawn on the front of the boat. And so in Acts 27:15, okay, head into the wind is to face into the wind. And so the boat actually kind of had a face. And that was their way of terminology. They put the face into the wind. Each ship had its own ensign or a distinctive symbol. It wasn't necessarily like we think of, you know, British ships with the woman carved on the front of the boat, but they might be sailing under a flag with a certain symbol on it, or they could have painted something on their boat or had something carved on it, but each boat had a identity. Acts 28 and verse 11. The figurehead of the twin brothers. Travel by land was not much better. They were at constant risk. Risk of bandits. Luke 10 and verse 30. He fell among robbers. And the trip from Jerusalem down to Jericho wouldn't have been a major journey. You wouldn't think you'd be so far off of civilization that you'd be at risk. But it was very rough territory and easy for robbers to hide. And so a lot of times people would travel in large groups. There was such a risk if you traveled alone or in a small group that you could be attacked and robbed and even killed. It was a hot climate, and so travel was very unpleasant, and oftentimes you'd be limited to the hours that you would travel, early mornings, late evenings, or even through the night. Can you give us an idea of somebody that might have traveled through the night? They were guided by a star. Okay, the wise men at Jesus' birth. Isaiah 58 and verse 11. A spring of water whose waters do not fail. You're traveling in an arid environment, and you, if you didn't know the way, you would hire a guide, or it was very valuable to have somebody in the caravan that had a knowledge of where all of the watering holes were located. You'd travel from watering hole to watering hole, not necessarily a direct straight road. It might go kind of wandering through the wilderness because you were limited to where the water was. But sometimes you'd get to that watering hole and the watering hole would be dried up. Then you got problems, right? You've got another day to the next watering hole. And so here it's talking about God's blessing being like a watering hole that never dries up. There was not the accommodations. We drive someplace, you go through any major town or city, and there are hotels everywhere. We have convenience stores. You can stop and get gas and pop and water and food and snacks and just about anything you need. And it's very convenient to travel. And that was not the case. There wasn't any accommodations in most of the places you'd travel to. You were really on your own. You had to take your food with you or provide it along the way. You had to be prepared to be camping out under the stars because there wouldn't be a hotel or even houses where you would be able to stop. You were dependent upon hospitality. You get to a town, you couldn't just put up at the local hotel. You were at I just think of that story in Judges where the man is traveling and he stops in the town. He was going to sleep in the town square. Nobody was being hospitable to him until one came along and brought him into his house. What a dangerous time that was. No accommodations. They would take bread and parched grain, figs, dates, olives. Let's look at Joshua 9, verses 3 through 6. Okay. We've come from a far country, and here's the evidence. Our bags are wore out. Our bags are empty. What little food we have left is moldy. They are portraying what it was like to be on a long journey. You wore out your shoes. You wore out your clothes. You wore out your supplies. Isn't that just a wonderful demonstration of the miracle that God did for Israel as they went wandered in the wilderness. They never wore out their clothes. But these men that came from a far city, a far country, it would have been a telltale evidence that they had traveled a long way because their shoes are worn out. You had to deal with animals. You know, we jump in a car and we will drive to Des Moines and back two or three times probably before we stop and think about checking the oil. We don't even think about it. Sometimes we get a flat tire because we forgot to check, you know. We know the tires go down in the wintertime and springtime, the temperatures change, and we didn't even care about it. But they had to deal with their animals. You didn't only feed yourself, you had to figure out how you were going to feed your animal on it. And if that animal was going to get sore feet or get injured or get, you know, a sore from the pack he's carrying, you couldn't travel as far as you wanted to. It wasn't like you could just pour more gas into the donkey. That donkey had to stop and rest. And so it was very inconvenient. Oh, I missed one there. Even in local travel, they would take 2 days' worth of food with them. You didn't leave home without being prepared. You never knew if you were going to be able to get back in time. So in Matthew 15, verse 32.
And Jesus called with me now 3 days, and had nothing to eat.
Okay, they've been with him 3 days, and so it was just practical knowledge that they're out of food. They carried 2 days' worth of food with them. That's what you left home with. Yeah, I didn't look into that specifically. There's just a few clues. You know, a Sabbath day's journey would have been 2 miles, a mile out, a mile back, which would have been a limited journey. In terms of a local trip would be something where you'd leave home and get home in the same day. Okay. And so that would be limited, of course, depending on terrain and things. But like a caravan of camels moved at 3 miles an hour. So I think I read someplace that you could maybe travel. So a day's journey would be 10 miles out and 10 miles back that you'd be doing. See, Genesis 24, verses 14 and 31 and 32.
Your master.
31 and 32.
And he said, "Come in to the men who were with him."
Okay, if you were going to be hospitable, that was quite a obligation. You had to feed the person, but you also had to feed his camels or his donkeys, his animals that he's traveling. There was an absence of good roads. Sometimes the roads were so poorly marked that if you didn't know where you were going, you could easily get lost. You'd just not be on the road and not even realize you got off the road. The road looks like everything else around you. And so it was easy to get off the road. Psalm 107, verses 4 through 7. Okay. Oh, sorry. Wandering out in the wilderness. That's a bad situation to get lost where there is no water, there's no food, there's no houses to stop to and get directions. So getting lost was a real danger. What roads they had were taken care of when the king had to come by. And we see this especially as they did develop roadways The picture there, Luke chapter 3 and verses 4 through 6. Okay, so when a king or royalty was going to make a trip, they would send an envoy out before them. It would be a road crew, and they would go, and all of the potholes that had developed, they'd fill them in. And if things had gotten rough from, you know, mud and you know, get ruts and things, they'd knock down the high spots and fill in the low spots, and they would proclaim the coming of the king before he would ever get there. And so that's kind of the picture that is given for John the Baptist, who was making the road straight and preparing the way. But Hebrews 12 and verse 13. So we're supposed to be doing this for one another as a task of love. you know, if all of the peasants would take care of their own road, the king wouldn't have to send out his envoy, would he? Travel was slow going. I just mentioned a camel caravan would travel about 3 miles an hour. Another thing that slowed them down was their sense of hospitality and greeting one another. If you came across somebody on the road and you stopped to greet them, it wasn't just say, "Hi, how's the road ahead?" It was this long, drawn-out questioning. I have to ask you about your family. I have to ask you about your business. I have to ask you how things are going. And just showing this deep interest in your life. And then you've got to spend that time, you know, showing deep interest in my life. And so this took a lot of time. You know, we zip past all kinds of people on the road. We don't even think of, you know, the closest thing, we might raise a finger to greet them. And we can't imagine what life would be if we had to stop and talk to everybody. In fact, Jesus didn't appreciate this at some points because his business was urgent. Luke chapter 10 and verse 4. Don't greet anyone on the road because it's urgent. You've got to get there quickly. If you greet somebody, you can't just stop at hi. It's going to take a lot of time. Roman couriers could go about 75 miles in a day on good roads. That's traveling light and so that would be kind of a maximum capacity for travel. Yeah, he's kind of like the Pony Express. He was moving. And the Roman road system had that. The Pony Express wasn't just an American thing. They had stations where they could swap out horses and supply themselves in moving the mail across the nation. Even then, it would take 54 days to go from Rome to Caesarea, 1,388 miles. And 1,388 miles is a pretty good trip in a car. You might break that up in a couple of days, but 2 months? That's a significant amount of time. You're waiting for the mail. And we get anxious for the mail if it's late. You know, it's been a week, 10 days. If the mail was late, it was over 2 months. Had to use animals, mainly donkeys. Mules were supposed to be forbidden for the Jews because it was the act of a mixed breed. But they argued with themselves, I guess, in thinking that as long as I don't do the breeding, it'll be okay. And so it was known the king's sons rode on mules. They used horses, but mainly not so much for riding the horse, but pulling their chariots and wagons. Camels were important, especially for trade. And there were two different kinds of camels. The one camel that had the one hump camel, with only one hump of fat, he wasn't very good at endurance, but he was very nimble. He was quick on his feet. So you wanted to get from one place to the other quickly, you rode a one hump camel. If you wanted to carry your load through the desert, you wanted a two hump camel, right? You wanted something that had more ability to store the energy that they needed. And camels could carry a lot more than a donkey, and so it was very efficient. But they would lead their camels, they would ride a donkey and have all of the camels on a leash behind, because, well, for one, you don't want to waste cargo space. But riding a donkey was not pleasant. They have this gait that rocks you back and forth like this. And so you get car sick riding on a donkey. And so it's, or on a camel. And so they would ride the donkey for comfort out in front of their camels. And of course, camels would be more expensive than a donkey. They would put a lot of camels together in a caravan, up to 1,500 camels. Now, not all chained directly to one another. And I didn't see how many they could chain together, but that's a lot of animals to take care of as you take them across the wilderness. To ride an animal was a privilege. It was the privilege of men and very prominent people. Women would not ride. And so we keep thinking about Mary when she was pregnant and taking this journey to Bethlehem. We get pictures of her riding on a donkey. That probably would not have been the case. It would have been completely culturally inappropriate for her. And yet we do see in 2 Kings 4:24 the wealthy woman that made a home for, I forget if it's Elijah or Elisha, but her son died and she saddled up the donkey and went to get the prophet. Use of carriages, of course, wheeled carriages required good roads. If you hit too many bumps, you break your wheels or an axle, or it would be very uncomfortable bouncing along. Rome had 50,000 miles of paved roads. Now, the Roman Empire is vast. Can't imagine. I tried to figure out, you know, well, what can we compare it to? Here in Iowa, we have 17,000 miles of paved roads. That is farm to market roads. That's not, you know, all of the paved roads in town and in odd places. I think we have about 18,000 miles of pavement in the state of Iowa. So you can imagine how extensive that road system was and how much maintenance it would have taken. And the Roman road system was a complex system. They started with a base of sand, and then they had two layers of concrete with different grade of rock in it. And then once they got that set, they put paving stones on top of it, kind of like going to one of these old towns and you drive on their brick streets. This would have been kind of like that. And it was graded so that the water would go off, and they had gutters along the side of it and kept the water away from the road. It was a very elaborate road for its time. And so, you know, that's where the saying comes from, all roads lead to Rome. And That was the whole purpose, that Rome would be able to govern such a vast empire so that they can get their government officials and their military across the land quickly. As you were traveling down the road, the Roman law allowed that a soldier could require you to carry his pack for 1 mile. And so, you know, I'm in a hurry. No, you're going to stop and walk an extra mile in the wrong direction just to carry his pack. These roads actually had mile markers, and so they knew how far they'd be able to use you according to their law. And so when Jesus tells them, if somebody compels you to walk 1 mile with them, walk two. You see how inconvenient and what a bad attitude we would have if somebody stopped us and made us do their work and go in the wrong direction for a mile. And Jesus is telling us, you know, watch your heart. Do you love these people? Go the second mile. The Roman road was a wonder of the world. Early on, you were at complete reliance at the hospitality of others. Inns were basically stopping places, sometimes with an empty shelter or a cave that you can get out of the weather. It wasn't manned, it wasn't supplied, it was just a spot. It was kind of a marking place. This is where you stop for the night, and then the next leg of the journey, you'll have another spot. As things developed, some of those became manned. They'd have an innkeeper, and he would provide to you the bare necessities. He might give you some coffee and have a fire going and maybe supply some hay for your animals. It was very basic. And then as you got to more civilized areas or where trade routes crossed, they would have built a building structure, kind of a square structure where the middle of it was a courtyard. You'd bring your animals into the courtyard, water them, there'd be a well or something there, feed them there. And then on the fancier ones, there were living quarters on a second level, so you got a little separation from your animal for the night. This was a place where oftentimes markets would spring up because you have these caravans coming across and they would be able to do business with one another or set up a market and do business with the local community. Those were called caravanserai, something like that. One of the problems is these were very well known for their prostitution, and so good moral people oftentimes would try to avoid these places. It was a place of drunkenness and immorality. Another thing that would slow you down and add expense along the way, you'd have to pay taxes. I've always appreciated Iowa not having toll roads, but there's a few that I've had experience with, and it's such an inconvenience to have to stop and dig up the change and throw it out there or whatever. But here, you're getting taxed. And you'd come up to this place and maybe they're going to tax you on the goods that you're carrying. Or they might tax you according to how many wheels you had on your cart or your chariot. Or how many axles. We kind of do that even today with semi-trucks and things. They count how many axles you're towing down the road. Very inconvenient. But there's a number of verses that I'll leave those up there. We won't look at them tonight. We're out of time. But you can take them down and look at them on your own time.